Welcome to Jeremy Rosen on the Torah, Episode 4, continuing the study of Bereshit, Genesis.
What is light? We know how we use the word light, but what is the relationship between light and enlightenment? The Torah continues describing the process of creation this way. The text says, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or, and God said, Let there be light. Here is the first actual divine command. But what does it mean by God creating light? It's the first act of creation, even though the text describes the things that were there before it: matter, water, space. When God says, let there be, it implies will, heavenly will, the will that is the requirement of conscious creativity, of the artist deciding to do something and then producing it. Divine will here predates, so to speak, the actual process of creative activity. So there has to be the plan. And this is the spiritual issue, whose value lies in the idea that spirit is more encompassing than matter, and even predates matter, and imposes itself on everything. Of course, one is bound to notice that, according to the text, there is chaos, tohu vavohu, which seems to predate all this activity. Many people in ancient Greece, such as Aristotle, believed that matter was eternal. It had been there all the time. That spirit, God, mind, was eternal, had been there all the time. And that at a certain moment in creation, the two come together. And they would have understood the text here as precisely describing this. There was something there beforehand when God, mind, intervened and said, let there be light. But if the sun and the moon were not put into place until the fourth day, what was light before that? It might be fun to suggest that the light came from other planetary systems, but I don't think, once again, one needs to find these points of similarity between the text and modern thinking. However, it is interesting how one could, if one wanted to, describe this as the energy that existed that led to the Big Bang and the explosion that science believes started the universe. One of the traditional explanations is that light is what we would call enlightenment, understanding. It reminds me a little bit of Kant, the famous philosopher. He said that the human needs a priori in advance to have some built-in information that assimilates all the information that comes into the brain from different places. You have to have some context. In other words, there needs to be a kind of intellectual plan, design, framework before anything actually happens. Now, the Midrash, which is the 2,000 or more year old oral interpretation of the Torah, says that this special light represented an alternative dimension, a spiritual one that only spiritual people could possibly understand. It is also another way of talking about the total picture of the universe, including the afterlife, the totality of a system of which the world we live in is only a small part. This is why the Midrash says that when God saw how good this original light was, he removed it from the imperfect material world and kept it solely for those souls who survived this world to make it through to the next. They would be the ones who would really know what to see and what was there. Light, therefore, is more akin to enlightenment than simply the waves of light in the spectrum that we human beings mean when we refer to it. So clearly, they thought it was not like the sun-based light. The text goes on to say, Vayehi Or, and there was light. The significance of repeating, and there was, seems unnecessary, except that it does assert that when God says something, and says he intends to do something, he carries it out, a kind of confirmation of his effective reality. But then what does it mean when it says, Vayara Elohim et ha'or ki tov, God saw the light and it was good? Of course it was good if God made it, surely. Does God make bad things? Well, some people have thought so. In modern philosophical terms, the word good is very debatable. If I say it is good to go to synagogue on a Saturday, a Christian says it's good to go to church on Sunday, a Muslim says it's good to go to the mosque on Friday, are they all good equally in exactly the same way to everyone? Is good, as Aristotle says, that at which all things aim, in which case a good mass murderer is good at what he does? But where's the moral value? Is good something intrinsic? Is a knife basically good or basically bad? Or does it depend rather on humans using it to cut up food or to stick into people? Perhaps good is what happens when a democracy votes for something. Then think of the democracy that voted to put Hitler in power in Germany. In Judaism, one can say that good means that which God approves of, or which the tradition approves of. So in a way, this statement establishes the basis of Jewish moral and ethical judgment. If God approves, then so do I. Of course, this does raise a problem. If Jewish law is what God approves of, then how can you have contradictory and different opinions within Jewish law and still say they're all the will of God? And yet, in fact, that's precisely what the Talmud says. 2,000 years ago, there were two major schools within rabbinic life that passed opinions and came to conclusions about different aspects of Jewish life. One was the school of Hillel, which tended to be more tolerant, outreaching, and the other was the school of Shammai, which tended to be more strict and inward-looking. They disagreed on many, many things, and the Talmud is full of their disagreements and of the occasions when they decided one way or another, usually in favor of Hillel. Now, the Talmud says that despite the fact that they disagree, both are the word of God. And it's a wonderful concept, and yet it's difficult to understand. But it really depends on how you understand law. If you understand law as being absolute, there can only be one and no other, then you do have a problem. But Judaism isn't quite like that. For example, you can break most of the laws of the Bible in order to save life. There are things that are required of a priest, for example, that are forbidden to a commoner. And so it's clear that in our tradition, law is a complex idea in which there can be variables and in which something may be right at one moment and not right at another. It's rather, I guess, like the Supreme Court interpreting the American Constitution and different judges interpret it in different ways. The text goes on to say, Vayavdel Elohim ben ha'or uven ha'choshech, and God divides between the light and the darkness. Dividing is normally taken to demarcate in a negative way, to divide good from bad, to separate. This term, lahavdil, havdalah, is mentioned here at the beginning of the process of creation, and again when, on the last day, we talk about Shabbat and dividing Shabbat from the rest of the week, the other days. But the term really means distinction rather than division, and marking a transition point. So the Havdalah ceremony we have when Shabbat goes out marks the transition from one type of way of living to another type of way of living. Both light and dark come from God. They are different. We need both, but at different times. Just as we need sleep, as much as we need to be awake. There's no value judgment, just a recognition of differences. And then the text goes on to say, Vayikra Elohim, and God called, Laor, to the light, Yom, day, v'lachoshech, unto the darkness, kara, called laila, night. God calls light day and darkness is called night. In general, we tend to consider night, dark, black, negatively. But in fact, the text here doesn't imply that at all. Once again, there is a neutrality that is the basis of the mystical, holistic approach that you find in Kabbalah, that everything comes from one divine source. Everything can be harnessed by humans creatively. Indeed, there's a tradition that prayer at the midnight hour, the blackest and darkest hour of the night, is the most powerful. God naming something is rather similar to the way that man names the animals in chapter 2, verse 20. Calling something a name recognizes difference, different functions, whether something is to be used one way or another. But whereas Havdalah, as we normally use it, means to divide in a preferential way, here it means simply a handle, something that describes, acquires a characterization of its own. It's the difference between calling me a human, a man, Jeremy, or calling me by my Hebrew name, Yerucham. Each says something about me in a different way. So calling kara in Hebrew is a strong word. It's much more powerful than simply saying vayomer, he said, or vaydaber, he spoke. Kara, to call, implies involvement. And that's why, for example, even in English, to be called means to be selected, appointed, and honored. And then finally, the text goes on to say vayhi erev, vayhi boker, Yom Echad. It was evening and it was morning, day one. Notice the position of evening first, before morning. It's the reason why all Jewish holidays and festivals begin in the evening and run through to the end of daytime the following day. Logically, you might think we should start with morning, rise and shine, start a new day. And indeed, the Talmud debates this issue, but it comes down firmly in favor, as the text does here, of putting night first. And then returns to the question of whether darkness is inferior to light or not. And clearly, there's no such implication. The Kabbalah suggests that a day, in Jewish terms, is like birth. The process begins in darkness, grows and thrives in darkness, before bursting out into creative light. Many commentators have noticed how the Torah uses the word Yom Echad, day one, instead of the first day, Yom Rishon. By not using Yom Rishon, the text implies that there was a lot going on in the creative process before the actual process described here, which raises the issue of how one is supposed to understand the 7 days of creation. Maybe it's just, if you like, a snapshot in a much bigger process. Just as one is faced with a problem of what day and night are without the sun and the moon, which don't appear until the fourth day, so here one is allowed to think, as again the Midrash does, that there was lots of creation going on, worlds that were made and destroyed and reshaped before we came to what we have today. For me, the issue is not whether this narrative fits into the evolutionary theory, although I do enjoy seeing lines such as these that lend themselves to reconciliation. I'm fascinated by how much actually does fit in with Darwinian templates, except, of course, I see divine intervention at work as much as natural selection. But what really matters are the lessons that you, I, we can learn from a close reading of the text that will be useful to us in the way we live our lives in the present.
This has been episode 4 of Rabbi Jeremy Rosen's podcast. For more information, please visit jeremyrosen.com. Thank you for listening.